Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Alan Levy Show on Blog Talk Radio. We can be found at www.blogtalkradio.com, where we are streaming live all over the world. And, of course, the archive, this broadcast tonight will be archived and can be found on Blog Talk Radio as well at blogtalkradio.com/AlanLevy. And we have a very exciting night tonight. I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. Tonight my guest will be Anatole Levin, who has written a fascinating book entitled Ethical Realism. As with all shows on Blog Talk Radio, this show is live and will be recorded as a podcast. Again, as I mentioned, you can find the podcast at blogtalkradio.com/AlanLevy. Or you'll be able to find the podcast at Anatole's website, which is www.newamerica.net. Now, Anatole will be joining us in a few moments, and if you'd like to call Anatole and pose a question tonight, we'd love to hear from you. We always love audience participation on Blog Talk Radio. And if you'd like to call, the number is 347-677-0649. That's 347-677-0649. Before Anatole comes on, I just want to go over a couple of housekeeping notes, remind you about two shows that are coming in the next week or so on Blog Talk Radio on the Alan Levy Show. On Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, Karel Balloon, one of the early Facebook engineers, will be my guest to discuss his upcoming book called Inside Facebook. It should be fascinating. As everyone knows, Facebook is an enormously successful social networking site, has around 10 million active members focused on the high school and college crowd, and I'm very interested in talking to Karel about that. And on Monday, November 13th at 9 p.m., we're very excited that Mike Arrington, the founder of TechCrunch, will be my guest to discuss the upcoming TechCrunch party, which will be held at BED. It's a bar or club in New York City on November 16th. So we're really excited about that. We'll probably publish something out on the evening with Mike Arrington, which is scheduled to be Monday evening, November 13th at 9 p.m. Well, let's get to my guest tonight for a very interesting evening, and he's a fascinating book he's just written with John Holtzman, a co-author. And Anatole Levin is a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation and is the author of America Right or Wrong, An Anatomy of American Nationalism. He writes regularly for the Financial Times and the International Herald Tribune, among other publications, and he lives in Washington, D.C. Anatole, good evening. How are you?
Hello. I'm fine, thank you.
Great, terrific. Well, thank you for joining us tonight on Blog Talk Radio. It's a pleasure to have you here tonight. I know you're in the middle of your book tour now, is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Pretty exhausting.
It's exhausting. And when did you start the tour, and how long will it proceed?
Well, you know, it's not one continuous tour. It's bits and pieces. John and I have been to California so far and Chicago, and we'll be going to New York and Boston, and probably a few places after that. We're not quite sure yet.
I see. Well, I read a lot of the book, and it's quite fascinating, and I want to get into it. There's a lot of information to cover tonight, and I'd like everyone to also once again remind everyone, if they'd like to call later in the show to ask Anatole a question, that number is 347-677-0649. Can you describe what ethical realism is?
What it is an attempt to bring together what we call the two halves of the American soul when it comes to foreign policy, which is on the one hand that a majority of Americans, quite rightly, have always insisted that their national foreign policy serve the interests of the American people and the American nation. On the other hand, a majority have always felt very uncomfortable with foreign policies based only on some kind of what's being called realpolitik, or national interests in a crude and cynical sense. There is this desire that American policy serve moral goals and be conducted by moral means. And it seemed to us that there were a number of great American philosophers and practitioners in the past who had exemplified a philosophy which brought together realism, a realistic defense of American national interests, with ethics. And we were thinking of three in particular, Reinhold Niebuhr, a great Protestant theologian, George Kennan, who was the architect of the containment of Soviet communist expansionism in the 1940s, and Hans Morgenthau, a refugee from Nazi Germany who became, in many ways, the father of modern American realist thought on international relations. So we went back to them for not exactly a new vision, but a reborn version of an old vision of how America should conduct its foreign policy. And the reason that we did this was that in recent years, you know, we'd not just become completely exasperated with the foreign policy of the Bush administration and what it's led to, but we also felt that the Democratic establishment, not the party as a whole by any means, but the Democratic establishment, was really failing to present a serious alternative to the Bush administration's strategy. And so we wanted to draw up a set of ideas which really would be a serious alternative to what we see, and of course so many other people see today, as a really disastrously failed approach in recent years.
Right. You start the book by discussing some successes in prior administrations, namely the Truman and Eisenhower administration and how they approached dealing with Korea, which could have, as you indicate, scaled into a world war, or as at least Truman did, right? And as well as the Marshall Plan in Europe. What's the, explain the relevance of this and how Truman was so successful, and how and counter that to what the Bush administration is doing in terms of handling their foreign policy for the last two administrations.
Well, the first thing is patience. Both Truman and Eisenhower decided that to defeat the Soviet Union would take a long, long time, that it was completely impossible, and not just because of nuclear weapons, but also for a whole set of other reasons. It's completely impossible to think of attacking and defeating the Soviet Union or China in the short term. Out of that came as well the rejection of preventive war as an idea. They both had the chance to launch attacks on the Soviet Union and China when those countries seemed to be very inferior militarily to the United States. But as Eisenhower said very wisely, look, it's not just a question of defeating the Soviet Union. Even if we get away with it without the Soviets launching a nuclear attack on America, what are we going to do with the shattered Russian society that results? How do we govern this place? How do we turn it into a successful state? Now, you know, these three things are obviously of crucial importance compared to the Bush administration. One, patience. You know, you don't seek radical solutions. You sit out these regimes. You prove to their peoples, in the end, and it may take decades, that democracy works better. The second thing is you reject preventive war. Truman once said that the only thing you prevent through war is peace. Because remember that both these administrations came under intense pressure from sections of the U.S. military, from lobbies in America, from the U.S. Congress to launch preventive attacks, and they both rejected them. And as we now see, this has worked out fantastically for America compared to the catastrophes that would have resulted if America had actually attacked or tried to invade Russia and China in the early 1950s. And the third thing is, and this Eisenhower in particular was so conscious of, having had to take responsibility for Italy and Germany after the Second World War, what do you do with the countries that you conquer? If you have a reasonable chance of turning them into successful modern free market democracies, that's one thing. But think very, very seriously about whether this is actually possible. And Eisenhower took a close look at the Soviet Union, and he thought, this isn't possible. We're going to simply take responsibility for a country which is going to be not just a disaster, but if we've attacked that country, it's also going to be savagely anti-American. And he told the American administration and establishment, no, I'm not going to do this. And so these three lessons, above all, we say, you know, are of critical importance to the United States today.
And I believe, and as I read in your book, that Keenan particularly had indicated that it was the economy of Russia would not succeed ultimately in the long run, and therefore it would crumble, or the Soviet bloc in that regard.
Exactly. That's just what he said. He said the communist model will not work economically, and not merely will it crumble, but the Western model will be seen to work much better. But what he said was precisely that it will take a long time for this to become evident. In other words, you know, we've got to have patience. We've got to wait. He also, you know, later very much advocated opening up to the Soviet Union, you know, establishing closer and closer relations to the Soviet Union. And he also advocated very much trying to establish close relations with Cuba. Because as many other people have said, isolating Cuba does not seem to have worked, you know, these past 40 years since the communist government there is still in power. Whereas, of course, trying to integrate Cuba into the world market economy would most probably have brought down communism in Cuba 25 years ago.
Yes. Now, before we get into some more of the book, I think it's important to note that this is really a bipartisan effort.
Mm-hmm.
John Holtzman, who couldn't be on tonight, but would have been interesting if the two of you were on together, does he represent the right side, and or how does that work? Because you do talk about it in the book, and I think it's important that you have, because you're not focusing on the weaknesses of the Bush administration per se. You're also focusing to a certain degree on the Democratic, that the Democrats don't have an answer either.
Well, that's just it. John calls himself an Eisenhower conservative or an Eisenhower Republican. He's very conservative in many ways, but he believes in a conservative and Republican tradition, which is completely different from that of the Bush administration. He also calls himself a Jeffersonian. In other words, he's very suspicious of the military industrial complex, of big security institutions. I regard myself as on the progressive side, particularly when it comes to environmental issues and global warming, but also when it comes to questions like equitable development. But, you know, like many moderate conservatives and moderate liberals, what we've come together in opposition to is, frankly, a foreign policy based on imperialism, you know, and based on a belief in the limitless expansion of American power. Now, it's possible that, you know, we might differ a bit if either of us thought that was possible. I mean, maybe if John believed that it was possible limitlessly to expand American power, he'd be for it. But the point is, what we've learned over the past few years is that it isn't possible. You know, that America is facing opposition in many parts of the world, most obviously in Iraq. Which means that, you know, America is a great deal less powerful than it seemed to be a few years back. And therefore, a strategy based on the idea that America is all-powerful is going to lead to either humiliation or disaster. And we both desperately want to avoid that, because we both of us actually still believe in American leadership in the world. But it has to be, you know, based on an accurate, rational sense of, you know, the limits on American power.
Okay, very good. Now we have a call that's actually come on, and would you like to take a call now? And
of course, with pleasure.
Perfect. So let's take a call, and then we'll go into some other things, and we'll see who's on. Um, 817, you are on Blog Talk Radio with Anatole.
Hello, Anatole.
Hello.
Name is Ted.
How do you do?
I just returned from China. Now, let's take this ethics kind of negotiations, if you will, and apply this to China. But China is absolutely the communist country right now. You know, they drastically reject the Western ways, the American intervention, if you will, and they claim that capitalism will in fact work. working, but with communism. Now, of course, that's one question. And the second thing, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the Taiwan issue and how Bush is attacking this Taiwan issue with China, especially in relation to the Korean issue now with nuclear war. Go ahead.
Well, I have to say, I really don't see China as in any real way a communist country anymore. It just has a party that calls itself the Communist Party. Then you could say that America has a party which calls itself the Republican Party. Parties can call themselves anything. I mean, what the Chinese have now is an authoritarian nationalist party, a bit like the party which ruled Taiwan until about 10 years ago, or 15 years ago. But of course, their whole, not just their economic policy, but their whole culture has become capitalist or free market. I mean, admittedly with Chinese features, but still. Also, of course, in much of China, not at the official level, but, you know, at the popular level, they're anti-American geopolitically and on national grounds, but as in so many other countries, this goes together in a funny way with tremendous admiration for American popular culture and Hollywood movies and American pop music. So it's a mixed picture in China today, but I really couldn't call them communist. On Taiwan and North Korea, what we say in the book is we can't hope to prevent China from being a great power in East Asia, nor can we hope to retain America as the dominant power in East Asia, because China is just going to become too strong for that. What we can do is try to bring the Chinese into a cooperative relationship in which we recognize their vital interests, but we give them a leading stake both in the region. I mean, we don't give them it. They're going to take it anyway, but we acknowledge a leading role for them in the region and the world at large. But we make the point to them again and again, and we back it up with just latent, nothing overt, but the latent presence of military force and with close relationships with some of China's neighbors like Japan and Vietnam. And the point we make to the Chinese is, look, you must not do anything over Taiwan, which is going to cause an international crisis which will bring the world economy down in ruins. You have as much interest in avoiding this as we do. We're both stakeholders in the world economy and in peace, so let's behave that way. But what we shouldn't do is give the Chinese the idea that we're backing the Taiwanese against them or that we're trying in any way to restrict Chinese power. On North Korea, we're extremely blunt. We say North Korea is China's problem. If you look at why the North Koreans have come back to the negotiating table in recent weeks, it's because the Chinese cut off their fuel. That means that the Chinese are simply much more powerful by now than America is in this region, and we need to acknowledge that. But we add something which you could call the realist bit of our equation, or even the cynical one, which is we say, look, one day the North Korean regime and system are bound to collapse, as all these other totalitarian systems have. Dealing with the subsequent problem is going to be an economic and financial nightmare. Now, do you actually want the American taxpayer to have to bear that burden? Well, since the Chinese have a vital interest in this area, and they say, you know, that it is their vital interest and not ours, why not give it to them and let them pay for it? You know, what we say is, we don't see why 50 years after the Korean War and 15 years after the end of the Cold War, we have to keep on defining North Korea as America's problem, when actually it's much more the problem of the Chinese and the South Koreans.
Okay.
Will they take ownership of it, the Chinese take ownership of the problem of North Korea?
Well, they already have to an extent, you know, by cutting the fuel, or threatening to cut the fuel supplies and bringing the North Koreans back. The Chinese problem, of course, is that they certainly do not want either a sudden collapse of the North Korean system, which would flood them with refugees, or, of course, they certainly don't want the two Koreas to be united under American control or with an American military presence. But other than that, I mean, it's very obvious now, if you go to Beijing, that the government in China has no love whatsoever of the North Korean regime, and also doesn't oppose by any means a reunification of the two Koreas, just as long as it doesn't involve American troops, you know, advancing up to China's borders.
Thank you, Ted, for that question and for calling in. Now, let's talk about Pakistan for a moment. And you mentioned in your book that Pakistan you define as the perfect case for ethical realism. And how so? Please describe that.
Well, we think that Pakistan is the classic case for the kind of strategy that Truman and Eisenhower pursued in East Asia. We don't really talk so much about the Marshall Plan in this context, because that was directed towards West European countries, which of course had been successful capitalist economies for, well, centuries almost. We're thinking much more about Taiwan, South Korea, Thailand, you know, to an extent, Malaysia. Now, all these countries during the Cold War, to strengthen them against communism, received enormous sums in American aid. I mean, fabulous ones by contemporary standards. And also, America kept its market open to exports from these countries so as to build up their domestic industries, once again, so that these countries could resist communism. And that's what we're advocating for Pakistan. But in addition, there's another factor which has been completely forgotten, which is that the Truman administration promoted radical land reform in South Korea and Taiwan and encouraged it elsewhere. I mean, this seems almost fabulous when you look at the Bush administration in recent years. But the argument was that you needed a stable, prosperous, land-owning peasantry, once again, you know, to avoid communist revolution. And what we need to do in Pakistan is a combination of all these three things. We need development aid, we need open markets, and we need equitable development. But we also need something else, which is a really long time frame. Because people talk again and again about whether, you know, Pakistan is going to collapse this year, next year, whether there are going to be free and fair elections in Pakistan. Transforming Pakistani society in a way that can really support true democracy is going to take a long time. But the other thing which we really, really have to worry about in Pakistan is the environment, and especially water. Because if global warming dries up the Himalayan glaciers, pretty soon you're going to have 250 million people in a country with hardly more water than the Sahara Desert. Now, at that point, all the things that we've been talking about in recent years about building democracy and building institutions are going to be completely meaningless. We have to find ways to help the Pakistanis improve their water situation, or everything else we do is going to become meaningless. And then you're going to have a country like Somalia, which is a perfect breeding ground for Islamist extremism, but of course 10 times the size of Somalia.
Fascinating. Now, Russia, and we'll move over to Russia here, which seems to me is quite a... It's fascinating to me how there's so much invested capital going into Russia. Of course, it's, you know, huge in resource, but in my view, at least, the Putin government has really, I mean, of course, they've taken over mass industries. They've imprisoned business leaders, entrepreneurs. The capital markets continue to throw money into Russia. And how do you think we should be dealing with Russia, and what's their position with the Chinese here?
Well, I mean, I have to say, as far as I'm aware, the Russians have only arrested and imprisoned one entrepreneur, which was Mikhail Khodorkovsky. And they did that not because he's an entrepreneur, but because he had stolen a huge amount of Russian state property in the 1990s and then used it to try to build himself up as a political kingmaker in Russia, you know, and to buy up deputies in the Russian parliament and create his own political parties.
So you disagree in that view then, that they've kind of shied away from, you know, really an open democratic society in terms of...
Oh, no, it's two different things, you see. I mean, Putin, clearly, I mean, if he had his druthers, he'd like to make Russia like China. In other words, a very closed political system, but actually a very, in most ways, a very open economic system. They haven't nationalized or taken over any part of the manufacturing sector in Russia. What they've done is they've basically taken back control of the oil sector, which admittedly is, of course, the most prosperous in Russia. But on the other hand, the Russians say that they're just doing, you know, I mean, most countries in the world control their oil sectors, except, of course, for America and Britain. But, you know, I mean, the Persian Gulf states do, Venezuela does, Mexico does, Indonesia does, Malaysia does. So, you know, it's not the Russians are standing out there. But, I mean, but you're right, of course, that Putin, you know, has introduced certain controls over democracy. Of course, he would say, or he did say, when I went to talk to him with a number of other experts last month, that, I mean, all that what Russia had in the 1990s was not democracy, that it was a horrible kind of Filipino-style oligarchy in which these big businessmen just looted the state and ran their own private armies, and that therefore, you know, he was simply restoring some kind of basic order and making sure that taxes were paid. I mean, the thing is that he has introduced greater controls of political parties and the media. The problem, however, if you say that he's not a Democrat, is that in doing all this, he does have the support of more than 70% of the Russian people, who very much approve of what he's done, because they found what happened in the 1990s, you know, was just absolutely catastrophic, for the point of view of their wages, their pensions, public services, crime, you know, all these.
What percentage of the German population in the 30s believed in what Hitler was doing, or the Nazi Party? I mean, well, I don't know if that's a determining factor, but...
Well, I mean, we know exactly, because Hitler got, in the last German election, free election, he got two-fifths of the vote. You know, so he didn't get a majority. But he also sort of seized, of course, he then seized power and suppressed everybody. But also, I mean, you know, Putin is not running a totalitarian state. The print media can write terrible things about Putin and do. What he's done is he's taken control of television, of course, which from his point of view, you know, I mean, there's a kind of... practical, or if you will, cynical calculation about this, because of course the vast majority of the Russian population get their news from television. But it's not, I mean, this is not Stalinism, or, well, it's not even the Chinese system. You know, there is a public debate in Russia.
Now, you're listening to Anatole Levin on Blog Talk Radio, and we're talking about this new book that he's written with John Holzman called Ethical Realism. If we could just shift over to, I guess it's probably the most relevant, the most important issue confronting the world today, and again, you're much more knowledgeable, so I would say, at least in my view, is Islamic fundamentalism and how the world, at many different levels, deals with this issue. And I think it's important, at least for our readers, or our audience, my audience, and the people on Blog Talk Radio and others, to maybe just have a brief overview of who the different players are here, because it can get confusing in terms of the Shia, the Sunni, Wahhabi, where does the Al-Qaeda fit into this? And there's a whole series of issues that I thought maybe we can kind of touch on here and approach this topic. It's quite complex, but it's quite relevant to the book that you've just written.
Sure. I mean, I should say as a matter of honor, because I've decided to do this on every occasion from now on in order to publicize the issue. But I think the most important issue, I mean, by far the most dangerous issue facing the world as a whole in the decades to come is global warming. and not Islamic fundamentalism.
Okay.
The problem is that, but Islamic fundamentalism, or I would say not fundamentalism, but radicalism, is perhaps the second most important. The problem is that John, you know, being indeed a Republican, could not agree with me on this, so we had to leave it out of the book. I mean, global warming.
That's why I didn't see it in the book. So I was up in Alaska last summer, and I can attest to you that the people that are giving the tours on the glaciers, they're screaming out loud, saying, "Please, please help us and listen to us up here." And when you're ready to write that book, you're more than welcome to come back on Blog Talk Radio.
Well, thank you so much. Yes, we did have, I think, one paragraph in the introduction to the book saying that we just hadn't been able to agree on this. But
well,
anyway.
We have a call. Let's just take another call, and we'll see, and then we'll cover that topic if you would like.
Sure.
You are on Blog Talk Radio. Hello?
Hello? Hi, thanks, Alan.
Yes, hi. Who are we speaking with?
This is John.
How do you do?
I'm doing well. Thank you for taking the call. I had a quick question, if that's okay.
Yes, please, John.
It's kind of off topic, because I know you're just talking about global warming and everything, but I was trying to find a good opportune time to to ask the question that I had, and I just wasn't getting it. My question to you, sir, is what do you feel the reality is for NATO's future? In dealing with a lot of the issues in the Middle East, you know, in the world as a whole today, do you think they can be effective as they have been, you know, or do you think their future might be uncertain?
Well, thank you, John.
I think NATO's future is uncertain. I think the decisive factor will be what happens in Afghanistan. If NATO forces are capable of making a really important contribution there, and a positive contribution, then I think that will give the alliance, you know, legs and a meaning for a considerable time to come. If, however, they fail there, and so far, as you must know, you know, they're really not doing very well, then I think the alliance will increasingly come to seem meaningless. And, you know, in Afghanistan, well, what do we have? The British and the Canadians have fought very hard, but the British essentially have been fought to a standstill by the Taliban in the south. They've actually had to retreat from one area. And the other countries, I mean, I say this with embarrassment and even shame as a European, although I'm British, as you can hear, so not too much shame, mm-hmm. but, you know, the Germans and the Dutch, their rules just don't allow them to fight. Frankly, they don't allow them to go out and seek out the enemy. And at that point, I mean, all these speeches by, you know, the Secretary General of NATO is Dutch now, Skeffer, are frankly not very convincing. And I don't see why they should be convincing to ordinary Americans. And if NATO can't do better than that, then, well, yeah, I mean, to a great extent, what is NATO for?
Thank you, John, for calling.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Now, Anatole, well, actually, back to Afghanistan for a moment. We had on Blog Talk Radio embedded journalist called in from the front lines. He was in Kandahar, and he called and did a show with us on Blog Talk Radio. It's quite fascinating, and he was talking about the things have really changed over there now in terms of NATO running the show, and it's a bit unsettling to the U.S. Military because they're used to running the operations there, so he made it very clear that that's what was going on in the front lines over there. And it's getting more difficult, of course.
Mm.
And I think that the large part, and there was some terrific piece on Frontline, and the western part of Pakistan has really been a hotbed of activity, Taliban activity, in the mountainous areas there that's causing a great deal of problem in Afghanistan right now.
Yes, it is.
So... Well, let's maybe cover the second most important issue pressing the world, in your view, which is Islamic fundamentalism. And as I said, it's a very complex matter, and I just have a few opening questions, at least for me, because I'm not an expert. I don't claim to be, but as I hear the rhetoric coming from Zarqawi and Osama bin Laden, and of course we had every right in the world to, in my view at least, go into Afghanistan after the attack. And
that was a
mandate, that we had a mandate for that action, and I would say perhaps we didn't have a mandate certainly for the Iraq action. But what it seems to me that these fundamentalists have hijacked a religion, their religion. And how is it that a small, and I don't know if the word sliver's right, but a very small subset of the 1.3 billion Muslims in the world speak on behalf of the Quran and speak on behalf of Allah in terms of their hatred for the Jews, their hatred for, you know, the jihad and the hatred for America and so on? Where's the moderate Islamic clerics or moderate, or are there? I mean, so that's one of the issues I was hoping you would address as you kind of talk about this, is the issue of Islamic fundamentalism in the Middle East and elsewhere.
Well, the vast majority of Muslim clerics, both Sunnis but also Shia in Iran, have denounced al-Qaeda and terrorism again and again and again. You know, denounced 9/11. They denounced, you remember, the dreadful massacre of children at Beslan in Russia. They've denounced al-Qaeda's massacres in Iraq. And they have declared that terrorism is, you know, contrary to the Muslim tradition. So it's not that on those issues that the majority of Islamic clerics have remained silent. There's just one problem, that the overwhelming majority of Muslims, including secular Muslims, liberal Muslims, you know, who work for Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, the two television and radio stations, Shia, Sunni, everybody, what have you, do sympathize with the Palestinians. And even if most have now come reluctantly to accept the existence of the State of Israel, they strongly oppose Israeli occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, the Palestinian territories, and they oppose what they see as American support for those strategies. And most unfortunately, al-Qaeda and its allies have been able to play on that. And there was a fascinating passage in a book by al-Qaeda's number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, which came out a couple of years ago, in which he was remarkably frank. And he said, basically, look, the great majority of Muslims and Arabs oppose our religious fundamentalist and political revolutionary ideology. They don't want to live in a Quranic state modeled on, you know, the Islam of the 7th century. But most Muslims and the overwhelming majority of Arabs do oppose Israeli behavior and American support for it. Therefore, we must emphasize as much as we possibly can that issue in order to get Muslims on our side. It was quite, in many ways, a remarkably frank thing for him to say in a book of that kind. But I think that's, you know, that is the strategy of the Islamist terrorists to a great extent, you know, to play up that issue, and to a lesser extent, you know, issues like Kashmir and Chechnya and so forth, in the hope of attracting to their cause Muslims who otherwise would not join them. And unfortunately, if you look at the public statements, you know, of these suicide bombers in England and would-be terrorists there, they are having some success, alas.
Yeah, it's quite scary. Now, you propose in the book that it's the responsibility of the Western powers, and I don't recall what you said about the other large Middle East powers or concerns, like Iran or Syria, or Jordan. But you do say that it's the responsibility of the Western Europeans, you would say. You would have them bear a large portion of the expense necessary to improve and build the Palestinian society, to improve the standard of living there, which, by the way, it doesn't seem to me that the leadership of the Palestinian Authority has done any reasonably decent job, you know, in the last 10 years or 15 years. And, of course, the conditions are not great, but it doesn't seem like they furthered that society. But talk about that a little, what you feel in terms of the Western Europeans and why they should really aggressively support the buildup of the Palestinian society.
Well, we say only as part of a peace settlement.
Right. Well, we're trying to find a settlement to this. So, I mean, as part of a peace settlement.
Yeah. I mean, we certainly do not advocate, just pouring money into the Palestinian territories without conditions.
No, for sure. No. I understand. Absolutely right. Of course.
But what we say is that, on this specific score, it is obvious that one of the conditions of a peace settlement is either no return or only very limited and symbolic return to Israel proper of Palestinian refugees who lived there or whose ancestors lived there before 1947. For the simple reason, of course, that if the refugees all went back, Israel would cease to be a Jewish state, at which point you can't possibly expect Israel to accept a settlement, and they won't. Equally, to get the Palestinians to accept a settlement, but also as a matter, it must be said, of natural historical justice, it is essential that these Palestinian refugees and their descendants be compensated. And we say this shouldn't just be seen as a matter of compensation, but it should also be seen as a kind of Marshall Plan for the whole region, that this compensation should be on a scale that would really transform the economies of the countries where the Palestinians live. I mean, obviously the Palestinian territories themselves, but also Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and to a lesser extent Egypt. And since America will undoubtedly compensate Israel, if it ever happens, for leaving the West Bank, the only bloc which can really generate most of the funds necessary to compensate the Palestinians and transform their economic prospects are the Europeans. And this is also, of course, only a matter of historical justice, given the European and naturally particularly the German history of extreme anti-Semitism. I mean, the Europeans do have a moral responsibility to contribute to a solution of this problem. So that's where we say that the Europeans have to be brought in to help the Palestinians, but only, of course, if the Palestinians accept a peace settlement with the Israelis and recognize the state of Israel.
There seems to be an increase in anti-Semitism throughout the world, perhaps. Maybe you can discuss this a bit. You know, of course, in the Middle East or Western Europe and in certain countries, through the colleges, even in America. Why do you feel that's happening? I mean, and it can't be just argued that, you know, the Israelis are occupying Palestinian land still. I mean, isn't it a broader issue, or is it just something that's maybe just becoming a bit more apparent?
Well, I mean, you know, if you look at real anti-Semitism, extreme anti-Semitism in Europe, I mean, it is above all the Muslim minorities in Europe. You know, the immigrants and their children. I mean, you know, that's obvious if you look at, you know, the originators of anti-Semitic crimes, demonstrations, and so forth. I mean, more, and that's true throughout the Muslim world. And it has, you know, it is due overwhelmingly to what they see as Israel's oppression of fellow Muslims. Outside the Muslim world, I mean, anti-Israeli feeling does or can shade over into anti-Semitism. But, you know, there was very little anti-Semitism in Europe I mean, after, of course, the defeat of the Nazis and the fascists, until the 1970s. And it began to come up again, above all because of the perception that, you know, Israel was acting as an oppressive state and that Jewish lobbies elsewhere in the world were supporting Israel in this. So, I mean, it does mostly, not exclusively, but mostly come back, you know, to people's perception of what Israel is doing.
I see. So you're saying it's more anti-Israeli behavior versus anti-Semitic behavior.
Well, in the Muslim world, the two have become merged to a great extent. In Europe, distinctions are still made. And, of course, you know, as you're well aware, there are a great many leading Jewish intellectual figures in the United States who have been very critical of Israeli policies without, you know, in any sense, obviously, being anti-Semites.
Yes, for sure. Well, particularly during the Lebanese war that recently occurred.
Yeah.
Obviously, a lot of mistakes were made there in that regard. So, what's your view, and do you discuss in the book the issue of the other governments of more dictatorships and, you know, like throughout Middle East and how they're dealing with this very large, aggressive Muslim population? I mean, we're talking more along the lines of Saudi, Egypt, and some of these other countries that have really, you know, they don't really take a view, but they're sitting on powder kegs, it seems like to me.
Well, I mean, they certainly take a view of Islamist, radical Islamist political movements. They sit on them, you know, all of them have suppressed such Islamist movements, sometimes very bloodily. You know, the Syrians crushed a radical Islamist revolt 25 years ago with extreme bloodshed. The Egyptians have spent, you know, much of the Egyptian regime has spent much of the past year breaking up demonstrations by the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And the Saudis, although they, of course, are Islamic fundamentalists themselves, when it comes to Al-Qaeda and its allies, they were, of course, very tolerant of them until a few years ago. But as soon as Al-Qaeda started aiming at a revolution within Saudi Arabia, they've started cracking down on them very hard, as of the Jordanians. So, you know, there's no lack of repression of, you know, the radical Islamists in this region. And, of course, as for the Iranians, well, they loathe Al-Qaeda and its allies on principle, because Al-Qaeda and its allies hate them, as you know, because they Al-Qaeda and its allies are Sunnis, and the Iranians are Shia, and they regard each other, you know, more or less the way that Catholics and Protestants in Europe regarded each other four centuries ago, you know, as the enemy number one.
But in these countries like Egypt and Saudi, what do you think the long-term prospects are? I mean, keep repressing Islamic fundamentalism in these countries, or militant, I guess, in regards to Saudi. I mean, where do you see that all this comes to play in the next 10 to 20 years?
Well, it depends. In the next 10 to 20 years, it depends above all on economic and social development first and foremost. I mean, if these countries can, you know, really develop their economies and societies, then there may be a hope that, you know, over time they can also begin to build or at least lay the foundations for future democracies. If they remain as economically undeveloped and stagnant as they have over the past 20 years or so, then, you know, there must be a fear that sooner or later these governments will be overthrown. And, I mean, it's, of course, you know, it's a complete mistake to suggest that all, you know, Muslim mass movements are somehow allied to Al-Qaeda. We've seen in Egypt how an Islamist but democratic party took power a couple of years ago, and you know this hasn't led to disaster, this hasn't led to terrorism or Islamist revolution. They're doing a perfectly decent job. And so obviously what we must hope is that some of these Islamist movements will also develop further in a democratic and moderate direction. And then, you know, frankly, if the majority of the population supports them, well, you know, we claim to be Democrats, they have the right to take power. But it's, you know, that would still be a worrying proposition at present, I think.
Now, you have a chapter, you know, rightly named, entitled, What is it's the Way Forward, I believe.
Mm.
And let's just talk a little about that. I mean, you've come up with a set of solutions, some of which you've discussed tonight on this show. What do you think is going to happen with, first of all, do you think that the elections, I know you're really a long-term thinker. I mean, that's what I'm getting a sense, because these are problems that take many years to develop and they'll take many years to resolve. We have an election going to happen on Tuesday. Number one, do you feel that's going to have any, is that going to help remove some of the paralysis or the stagnation, the lack of policy making, I think? I don't know. I mean, what's your view about this coming election? And what's your view about, really, how do we move forward? How does the U.S. administration, whichever it may be, because Bush is up in 2 years, as you know. So what's your view towards that? What is the way forward for us as a nation?
Well, first, we say there just has to be a much deeper and more open public debate. What we're hoping is that if the Democrats win on Tuesday, which, I mean, it certainly seems they'll win the House. I hope myself they'll win the Senate as well. But we hope that will lead to a real debate in both the Republican and the Democratic parties. The Republicans will have to hold a real debate on foreign policy, because they've lost. I mean, they can't just go on the way they have been at that point, or they'll be facing disaster in 2008. On the other hand, it's also true that the Democrats have been able to get away for years now with just attacking the Bush administration, saying how incompetent the Bush administration is, how all its ideas have been wrong, how its plans have been wrong, how it's lied, and so forth. Now, that is absolutely true, and I would support every word of it. The problem is that if you're a party which controls Congress and which is, you know, really running for office for the presidency in 2008, that's not enough. You've really got to come up with a serious alternative vision yourself. And so we also hope that there will also then be a really serious debate among the Democrats, and that both parties will have to come up with new ideas. And not just general new ideas, which is very easy, but that they will have to say concretely what they will do differently in the Middle East with regard to Iran, with regard to Afghanistan, Russia, China, development, the environment, and so on.
I feel like the it's so frustrating to listen to the representatives of both parties. It's also frustrating to watch the news. I mean, just the CNNs, the Foxes, I mean, they all seem to have their own particular slants of things.
Mm.
And it's a very frustrating thing. I don't believe it allows for proper debate. I fully agree with you.
Well, that's one reason why John and I wanted to write this book together, because we really felt that this kind of, you know, Punch and Judy, Abbott and Costello Act, of the two-party establishments was not leading to a real debate in this country, partly precisely because, in the end, I mean, if you look at much of what the Democrat Leadership Council has been saying and what more moderate supporters of the administration has been saying, on many issues they've been saying the same thing. And neither of them have come up with, for example, a new way of approaching Iran or the North Korean nuclear issue or Israeli-Palestinian peace, or what to do about Iraq, or in general. I mean, what we really insist on again and again is that it is the responsibility of anyone who is a policymaker or who wants to be a policymaker to be prepared to make choices over foreign policy, even if that is going to lead to domestic unpopularity, to attacks from one quarter or another. Because, you know, the failure to make choices in recent years has been based partly on cowardice, but also to a considerable extent on a belief that you didn't need to make choices because America was all-powerful, it could do whatever it liked. And it's obvious that that's just not true. That, you know, we see that not just from Iraq, from what's happening in Afghanistan, but also, you know, from North Korea as well. America has had to rely on the Chinese to look for a solution to this problem. Now, that means, you know, if you need China for North Korea, then you've got, there are things you are not going to be able to do to China in other areas. Ditto if you really need Russia over Iran. If one's really going to push for Israeli-Palestinian peace, you have to make choices about policy towards Israel. And, you know, in this book, we do set out very concretely the choices that we would make. At least John may make it one day. I'm British, as you can hear. My son is an American citizen, so maybe he'll get to make them, and I'll advise him.
I see that. And have you spoken with what's the feedback been of your book and your proposals with some of the government, some of the leaders, representatives of our government? Have you spoken to them?
Well, as you can probably imagine, the Bush administration does not regard John or me with any great favor, and indeed, John lost his job at the Heritage for criticizing the administration and the neoconservatives. But we've had very positive feedback from moderate Republicans. Brent Scowcroft actually endorsed our book. You know, his endorsement is on the back cover. Dimitri Sines, the head of the Nixon Center. We believe that Republicans like Chuck Hagel will be very positive towards our book. On the Democratic side, somewhat to our amazement, on Wednesday, Hillary Clinton made some very positive remarks about it at the Council on Foreign Relations. And, you know, we got an endorsement of the book from Seymour Hersh, a great liberal journalist, from Gary Hart, former Democratic candidate for president. So we really do feel that in both parties there are moderate, pragmatic people, you know, who they may not agree with all of our recommendations. Indeed, some of them certainly don't. But they are open to them. They're prepared to listen. And I must say, I think poor John, as a Republican, was rather horrified to be endorsed by Hillary Clinton. But I was delighted.
Yeah, well, that makes for good reading too. It's it's actually refreshing to have people speak their mind and represent both parties and say, hey, look, guys, we don't think either of you are doing a good job of it. You know, that someone's got to stand up, and we've got at least some ideas to resolve some of these problems that are very complicated. And I think if actually the Democrats do take the House, you'll see more moderation, I would hope, and then maybe some of your policies and ideas will percolate up in the next, you know, administration.
Well, I certainly hope so. And something that really motivated John and me as well, you know, also in, well, really speaking out concretely about some of these issues is, you know, we are asking our soldiers, British as well as Americans, you know, to risk their lives and, you know, all too often to die in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that, you know, if you're going to ask for that kind of courage from your servicemen, you as a policymaker or a foreign policy advisor, you simply have a duty, you know, as a matter of patriotism and honor, to be at least morally courageous yourself in speaking clearly. And we did feel also that, you know, what is obviously by now, in effect, a lost war in Iraq will or certainly should stimulate real debate in this country.
I think you should be commended in that you not only do you, I mean, you do find certain fault with how the Bush administration approaches the world and the world affairs, but you don't simply find fault. You're proposing solutions, and not many do the second part of that, propose the solutions, and for that you should be commended. And
thank you.
I want to thank you for joining me tonight. You're on Blog Talk Radio. I appreciate you joining us. This platform, Blog Talk Radio, is one that actually this call is broadcast throughout the world, can be heard anywhere whoever has an internet connection. And it's a new platform, and it's one that I'm excited that you're on. And I hope in the coming months, weeks, years, that we'll have more of these types of open debates where representatives of both parties can feel comfortable to chat and talk and try to find solutions, much like you've done.
Well, thank you so much. I'm most grateful.
Thank you. Have a good evening, Anatole.
Good night.
Good night. My guest tonight was Anatole Levin. He has written the book Ethical Realism. Really a very, very bright individual. Enjoyed it. Fascinating things. I tell you, if I was leading one of the parties, a Democrat or Republican party, I would engage the help of both these individuals, and I want to thank them for joining me, and I'd like to thank you for joining us on Blog Talk Radio. Have a good evening.